to the country, to a cabin I own in the Berkshires. If you want to see me, Eddie Willers will tell you the way to get there. I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Will you do me a favor?
Yes.
Don't come back until I come for you.
But I want to be here when it happens.
Leave that up to me.
Whatever they do to you, I want it done to me also.
Leave it up to me.
Dearest, don't you understand?
I think that what I want most right now is what you want, not to see any of them. But I have to stay here for a while, so it will help me if I know that you, at least, are out of their reach. I want to keep one clean point in my mind to lean against. It will be only a short while, and then I'll come for you. Do you understand?
Yes, my darling. So long. It was weightlessly easy to walk out of her office and down the stretching halls of Taggart Transcontinental. She walked, looking ahead, her steps advancing with the unbroken, unhurried rhythm of finality. Her face was held level, and it had a look of astonishment, of acceptance, of repose. She walked across the concourse of the terminal. She saw the statue of Nathaniel Taggart, but she felt no pain from it and no reproach. Only the rising fullness of her love. Only the feeling that she was going to join him, not in death, but in that which had been his life. The first man to quit at Reardon Steel was Tom Colby, rolling mill foreman, head of the Reardon Steelworkers Union. For 10 years he had heard himself denounced throughout the country because his was a company union, and because he had never engaged in a violent conflict with the management. This was true. No conflict had ever been necessary. Reardon paid a higher wage scale than any union scale in the country, for which he demanded, and got, the best labor force to be found anywhere. When Tom Colby told him that he was quitting, Reardon nodded without comment or question. "I won't work under these conditions myself," Colby added quietly, "and I won't help to keep the men working. They trust me. I won't be the Judas goat leading them to the stockyards."
"What are you going to do for a living?" asked Reardon.
"I've saved enough to last me for about a year.
And after that?" Colby shrugged.
Reardon thought of the boy with the angry eyes, who mined coal at night as a criminal. He thought of all the dark roads, the alleys, the backyards of the country, where the best of the country's men would now exchange their services in jungle barter, in chance jobs, in unrecorded transactions. He thought of the end of that road. Tom Colby seemed to know what he was thinking. "You're on your way to end up right alongside of me, Mr. Reardon," he said. "Are you going to sign your brains over to them?"
"No."
"And after that?" Reardon shrugged. Colby's eyes watched him for a moment, pale, shrewd eyes and a furnace-tanned face with soot-engraved wrinkles. "They've been telling us for years that it's you against me, Mr. Reardon, but it isn't. It's Orrin Boyle and Fred Kinnon against you and me."
"I know it."
The wet nurse had never entered Reardon's office, as if sensing that that was a place he had no right to enter. He always waited to catch a glimpse of Reardon outside. The directive had attached him to his job, as the mill's official watchdog of over- or under-production. He stopped Reardon a few days later in an alley between the rows of open-hearth furnaces. There was an odd look of fierceness on the boy's face. "Mr. Reardon," he said, "I wanted to tell you that if you want to pour 10 times the quota of Reardon metal or steel or pig iron or anything, and bootleg it all over the place to anybody at any price, I want to tell you to go ahead. I'll fix it up. I'll juggle the books. I'll fake the reports. I'll get phony witnesses. I'll forge affidavits. I'll commit perjury. So you don't have to worry. There won't be any trouble."
"Now why do you want to do that?" asked Reardon, smiling.
But his smile vanished when he heard the boy answer earnestly, "Because I want, for once, to do something moral."
"That's not the way to be moral," Reardon started, and stopped abruptly,
realizing that it was the way, the only way left, realizing through how many twists of intellectual corruption upon corruption this boy had to struggle toward his momentous discovery. "I guess that's not the word," the boy said sheepishly. "I know it's a stuffy old-fashioned word. That's not what I meant. I meant..." There was a sudden, desperate cry of incredulous anger. "Mr. Reardon, they have no right to do it."
"What?"
"Take Reardon metal away from you."
Reardon smiled, and prompted by a desperate pity, said, "Forget it, non-absolute. There are no rights. I know there aren't, but I mean... What I mean is that they can't do it.
Why not? He could not help smiling.
Mr. Reardon, don't sign the gift certificate. Don't sign it on principle.
I won't sign it. But there aren't any principles.
I know there aren't.
He was reciting it in full earnestness, with the honesty of a conscientious student.
I know that everything is relative, and that nobody can know anything, and that reason is an illusion, and that there isn't any reality. But I'm just talking about Reardon metal. Don't sign, Mr. Reardon. Morals are no morals. Principles are no principles. Just don't sign it, because it isn't right.
No one else mentioned the directive in Reardon's presence. Silence was the new aspect about the mills. The men did not speak to him when he appeared in the workshops, and he noticed that they did not speak to one another. The personnel office received no formal resignations, but every other morning one or two men failed to appear, and never appeared again. Inquiries at their homes found the homes abandoned and the men gone. The personnel office did not report these desertions, as the directive required. Instead, Reardon began to see unfamiliar faces among the workers, the drawn, beaten faces of the long unemployed, and heard them addressed by the names of the men who had quit. He asked no questions. There was silence throughout the country. He did not know how many industrialists had retired and vanished on May 1st and 2nd, leaving their plants to be seized. He counted 10 among his own customers, including McNeil of the McNeil Car Foundry in Chicago. He had no way of learning about the others. No reports appeared in the newspapers. The front pages of the newspapers were suddenly full of stories about spring floods, traffic accidents, school picnics, and golden wedding anniversaries. There was silence in his own home. Lillian had departed on a vacation trip to Florida in mid-April. It had astonished him as an inexplicable whim. It was the first trip she had taken alone since their marriage. Philip avoided him with a look of panic. His mother stared at Reardon in reproachful bewilderment. She said nothing, but she kept bursting into tears in his presence, her manner suggesting that her tears were the most important aspect to consider in whatever disaster it was that she sensed approaching. On the morning of May 15th, he sat at the desk in his office above the spread of the mills and watched the colors of the smoke rising to the clear blue sky. There were spurts of transparent smoke, like waves of heat, invisible but for the structures that shivered behind them. There were streaks of red smoke, and sluggish columns of yellow, and light floating spirals of blue, and the thick, tight, swiftly pouring coils that looked like twisted bolts of satin, tinged a mother-of-pearl pink by the summer sun. The buzzer rang on his desk, and Miss Ives' voice said, "Dr. Floyd Ferris to see you without appointment, Mr. Reardon." In spite of its rigid formality, her tone conveyed the question, "Shall I throw him out?" There was a faint movement of astonishment in Reardon's face, barely above the line of indifference. He had not expected that particular emissary. He answered evenly, "Ask him to come in." Dr. Ferris did not smile as he walked toward Reardon's desk. He merely wore a look suggesting that Reardon knew full well that he had good reason to smile, and so he would abstain from the obvious. He sat down in front of the desk, not waiting for an invitation. He carried a briefcase, which he placed across his knees. He acted as if words were superfluous, since his reappearance in this office had made everything clear. Reardon sat watching him in patient silence. "Since the deadline for the signing of the National Gift Certificates expires tonight at midnight," said Dr. Ferris in the tone of a salesman extending a special courtesy to a customer, "I've come to obtain your signature, Mr. Reardon." He paused with an air of suggesting that the formula now called for an answer. "Go on," said Reardon. "I am listening." "Yes, I suppose I should explain," said Dr. Ferris, "that we wish to get your signature early in the day in order to announce the fact on a national news broadcast. Although the gift program has gone through quite smoothly, there are still a few stubborn individualists left who have failed to sign, small fry really, whose patents are of no crucial value. But we cannot let them remain unbound, as a matter of principle, you understand. They are, we believe, waiting to follow your lead. You have a great popular following, Mr. Reardon, much greater than you suspected or knew how to use. Therefore, the announcement that you have signed will remove the last hopes of resistance, and by midnight we'll bring in the last signatures, thus completing the program on schedule." Reardon knew that of all possible speeches, this was the last Dr. Ferris would make if any doubt of his surrender remained in the man's mind.
"Go on," said Reardon evenly. "You haven't finished."
"You know, as you have demonstrated at your trial, how important it is, and why, that we obtain all that property with the voluntary consent of the victims." Dr. Ferris opened his briefcase. "Here is the gift certificate, Mr. Reardon. We have filled it out, and all you have to do is to sign your name at the bottom." The piece of paper, which he placed in front of Reardon, looked like a small college diploma, with the text printed in old-fashioned script, and the particulars inserted by typewriter. The thing stated that he, Henry Reardon, hereby transferred to the nation all rights to the metal alloy now known as Reardon metal, which would henceforth be manufactured by all who so desired, and which would bear the name of Miracle metal, chosen by the representatives of the people. Glancing at the paper, Reardon wondered whether it was a deliberate mockery of decency, or so low an estimate of their victim's intelligence, that it made the designers of this paper print the text across a faint drawing of the Statue of Liberty. His eyes moved slowly to Dr. Ferris's face. "You would not have come here," he said, "unless you had some extraordinary kind of blackjack to use on me. What is it?" "Of course," said Dr. Ferris. "I would expect you to understand that. That is why no lengthy explanations are necessary." He opened his briefcase. "Do you wish to see my blackjack? I have brought a few samples." In the manner of a card sharp, whisking out a long fan of cards with one snap of the hand, he spread before Reardon a line of glossy photographic prints. They were photostats of hotel and auto court registers, bearing, in Reardon's handwriting, the names of Mr. and Mrs. J. Smith. "You know, of course," said Dr. Ferris softly, "but you might wish to see whether we know it that Mrs. J. Smith is Miss Dagny Taggart." He found nothing to observe in Reardon's face. Reardon had not moved to bend over the prints, but sat looking down at them with grave attentiveness, as if from the perspective of distance he were discovering something about them which he had not known. "We have a great deal of additional evidence," said Dr. Ferris, and tossed down on the desk a photostat of the jeweler's bill for the ruby pendant. "You wouldn't care to see the sworn statements of apartment house doormen and night clerks. They contain nothing that would be new to you except the number of witnesses who know where you spent your nights in New York for about the last 2 years. You mustn't blame those people too much. It's an interesting characteristic of epochs such as ours that people begin to be afraid of saying the things they want to say, and afraid, when questioned, to remain silent about things they'd prefer never to utter. That is to be expected. But you would be astonished if you knew who gave us the original tip." "I know it," said Reardon. His voice conveyed no reaction. The trip to Florida was not inexplicable to him any longer. "There is nothing in this blackjack of mine that can harm you personally," said Dr. Ferris. "We knew that no form of personal injury would ever make you give in. Therefore, I am telling you frankly that this will not hurt you at all. It will only hurt Miss Taggart." Reardon was looking straight at him now, but Dr. Ferris wondered why it seemed to him that the calm, closed face was moving away into a greater and greater distance. "If this affair of yours is spread from one end of the country to the other," said Dr. Ferris, "by such experts in the art of smearing as Bertram Scudder, it will do no actual damage to your reputation, beyond a few glances of curiosity and a few raised eyebrows in a few of the stuffier drawing rooms. You will get off quite easily. Affairs of this sort are expected of a man. In fact, it will enhance your reputation. It will give you an aura of romantic glamour among the women, and among the men it will give you a certain kind of prestige in the nature of envy for an unusual conquest. But what it will do to Miss Taggart, with her spotless name, her reputation for being above scandal, her peculiar position of a woman in a strictly masculine business, what it will do to her, what she will see in the eyes of everyone she meets, what she will hear from every man she deals with, I will leave that up to your own mind to imagine. And to consider." Reardon felt nothing but a great stillness and a great clarity. It was as if some voice were telling him sternly, "This is the time. The scene is lighted. Now look." And standing naked in the great light, he was looking quietly, solemnly, stripped of fear, of pain, of hope, with nothing left to him but the desire to know. Dr. Ferris was astonished to hear him say slowly, in the dispassionate tone of an abstract statement that did not seem to be addressed to his listener, "But all your calculations rest on the fact that Miss Taggart is a virtuous woman, not the slut you're going to call her." "Yes, of course," said Dr. Ferris. and that this means much more to me than a casual affair. Of course. If she and I were the kind of scum you're going to make us appear, your blackjack wouldn't work. No, it wouldn't. If our relationship were the depravity you're going to proclaim it to be, you'd have no way to harm us. No, we'd be outside your power. Actually, yes. It was not to Dr. Ferris that Reardon was speaking. He was seeing a long line of men stretched through the centuries from Plato onward, whose heir and final product was an incompetent little professor with the appearance of a gigolo and the soul of a thug. "I offered you once a chance to join us," said Dr. Ferris. "You refused. Now you can see the consequences. How a man of your intelligence thought that he could win by playing it straight, I can't imagine." "But if I had joined you," said Reardon, with the same detachment as if he were not speaking about himself, "what would I have found worth looting from Orrin Boyle?" "Oh, hell, there's always enough suckers to expropriate in the world." "Such as Miss Taggart, as Ken Daniger, as Alice Wyatt, as I. Such as any man who wants to be impractical." "You mean that it is not practical to live on Earth, is it?" He did not know whether Dr. Ferris answered him. He was not listening any longer. He was seeing the pendulous face of Orrin Boyle with the small slits of pig's eyes, the doughy face of Mr. Moen with the eyes that scurried away from any speaker and any fact. He was seeing them go through the jerky motions of an ape performing a routine it had learned to copy by muscular habit, performing it in order to manufacture Reardon metal with no knowledge and no capacity to know what had taken place in the experimental laboratory of Reardon Steel through 10 years of passionate devotion to an excruciating effort. It was proper that they should now call it miracle metal. A miracle was the only name they could give to those 10 years and to that faculty from which Reardon metal was born. A miracle was all that the metal could be in their eyes, the product of an unknown, unknowable cause, an object in nature not to be explained, but to be seized, like a stone or a weed, theirs for the seizing. "Are we to let the many remain in want while the few withhold from us the better products and methods available?" "If I'd not known that my life depends on my mind and my effort," he was saying soundlessly to the line of men stretched through the centuries, "if I had not made it my highest moral purpose to exercise the best of my effort in the fullest capacity of my mind, in order to support and expand my life, you would have found nothing to loot from me, nothing to support your own existence. It is not my sins that you're using to injure me, but my virtues by your own acknowledgment, since your own life depends on them, since you need them, since you do not seek to destroy my achievement, but to seize it." He remembered the voice of the gigolo of science, saying to him, "We're after power, and we mean it. You fellows were pikers, but we know the real trick." "We were not after power," he said to the gigolo's ancestors in spirit, "and we did not live by means of that which we condemned. We regarded productive ability as virtue, and we let the degree of his virtue be the measure of a man's reward. We drew no advantage from the things we regarded as evil. We did not require the existence of bank robbers in order to operate our banks, or of burglars in order to provide for our homes, or of murderers in order to protect our lives. But you need the products of a man's ability. Yet you proclaim that productive ability is a selfish evil, and you turn the degree of a man's productiveness into the measure of his loss. We live by that which we held to be good, and punished that which we held to be evil. You live by that which you denounce as evil, and punish that which you know to be good." He remembered the formula of the punishment that Lillian had sought to impose on him, the formula he had considered too monstrous to believe, and he saw it now in its full application, as a system of thought, as a way of life, and on a world scale. There it was, the punishment that required the victim's own virtue as the fuel to make it work, his invention of Reardon metal being used as the cause of his expropriation, Dagny's honor, and the depth of their feeling for each other being used as a tool of blackmail, a blackmail from which the depraved would be immune. And in the people states of Europe, millions of men being held in bondage by means of their desire to live, by means of their energy drained in forced labor, by means of their ability to feed their masters, by means of the hostage system, of their love for their children or wives or friends, by means of love, ability, and pleasure, as the fodder for threats and the bait for extortions. With love tied to fear, ability to punishment, ambition to confiscation, with blackmail as law, with escape from pain, not quest for pleasure, as the only incentive to effort and the only reward of achievement. Men held enslaved by means of whatever living power they possessed and of whatever joy they found in life. Such was the code that the world had accepted, and such was the key to the code, that it hooked man's love of existence to a circuit of torture, so that only the man who had nothing to offer would have nothing to fear, so that the virtues which made life possible and the values which gave it meaning became the agents of its destruction, so that one's best became the tool of one's agony, and man's life on earth became impractical. "Yours was the code of life," said the voice of a man whom he could not forget. "What, then, is theirs?" Why had the world accepted it, he thought? How had the victims come to sanction a code that pronounced them guilty of the fact of existing? And then the violence of an inner blow became the total stillness of his body, as he sat looking at a sudden vision. Hadn't he done it also? Hadn't he given his sanction to the code of self-damnation? Dagny, he thought, and the depth of their feeling for each other, the blackmail from which the depraved would be immune. Hadn't he, too, once called it depravity? Hadn't he been first to throw at her all the insults which the human scum was now threatening to throw at her in public? Hadn't he accepted his guilt, the highest happiness he had ever found? "You who won't allow 1% of impurity into an alloy of metal," the unforgotten voice was saying to him, "what have you allowed into your moral code?" "Well, Mr. Reardon," said the voice of Dr. Ferris, "do you understand me now? Do we get the metal, or do we make a public show place out of Miss Taggart's bedroom?" He was not seeing Dr. Ferris. He was seeing in the violent clarity that was like a spotlight tearing every riddle open to him, the day he met Dagny for the first time. It was a few months after she had become vice president of Taggart Transcontinental. He had been hearing skeptically for some time the rumors that the railroad was run by Jim Taggart's sister. That summer, when he grew exasperated at Taggart's delays and contradictions over an order of rail for a new cutoff, an order which Taggart kept placing, altering, and withdrawing, somebody told him that if he wished to get any sense or action out of Taggart Transcontinental, he'd better speak to Jim's sister. He telephoned her office to make an appointment, and insisted on having it that same afternoon. Her secretary told him that Miss Taggart would be at the construction site of the new cutoff that afternoon at Milford Station, between New York and Philadelphia, but would be glad to see him there if he wished. He went to the appointment resentfully. He did not like such business women as he had met, and he felt that railroads were no business for a woman to play with. He expected a spoiled heiress who used her name and sex as substitute for ability, some eyebrow-plucked, over-groomed female, like the lady executives of department stores. He got off the last car of a long train far beyond the platform of Milford Station. There was a clutter of sidings, freight cars, cranes, and steam shovels around him, descending from the main track down the slope of a ravine where men were grading the roadbed of the new cutoff. He started walking between the sidings toward the station building. Then he stopped. He saw a girl standing on top of a pile of machinery on a flat car. She was looking off at the ravine, her head lifted, strands of disordered hair stirring in the wind. Her plain gray suit was like a thin coating of metal over a slender body against the spread of sun-flooded space and sky. Her posture had the lightness and unself-conscious precision of an arrogantly pure self-confidence. She was watching the work, her glance intent and purposeful, the glance of competence enjoying its own function. She looked as if this were her place, her moment in her world. She looked as if enjoyment were her natural state. Her face was the living form of an active, living intelligence, a young girl's face with a woman's mouth. She seemed unaware of her body except as of a taut instrument, ready to serve her purpose in any manner she wished. Had he asked himself a moment earlier whether he carried in his mind an image of what he wanted a woman to look like, he would have answered that he did not. Yet seeing her, he knew that this was the image, and that it had been for years. But he was not looking at her as at a woman. He had forgotten where he was and on what errand. He was held by a child's sensation of joy in the immediate moment by the delight of the unexpected and undiscovered. He was held by the astonishment of realizing how seldom he came upon a sight he truly liked, liked in complete acceptance and for its own sake. He was looking up at her with a faint smile, as he would have looked at a statue or a landscape, and what he felt was the sheer pleasure of the sight, the purest aesthetic pleasure he had ever experienced. He saw a switchman going by, and he asked, pointing, "Who is that?" "Dagny Taggart," said the man, walking on. Reardon felt as if the words struck him inside his throat. He felt the start of a current that cut his breath for a moment, then went slowly down his body, carrying in its wake a sense of weight, a drained heaviness that left him no capacity but one. He was aware with an abnormal clarity of the place, the woman's name, and everything it implied, but all of it had receded into some outer ring and had become a pressure that left him alone in the center, as the ring's meaning and essence. And his only reality was the desire to have this woman now, here, on top of the flat car in the open sun, to have her before a word was spoken between them, as the first act of their meeting, because it would say everything, and because they had earned it long ago. She turned her head. In the slow curve of the movement, her eyes came to his and stopped. He felt certain that she saw the nature of his glance, that she was held by it, yet did not name it to herself. Her eyes moved on, and he saw her speak to some man who stood beside the flat car taking notes. Two things struck him together: his return to his normal reality, and the shattering impact of guilt. He felt a moment's approach to that which no man may feel fully and survive, a sense of self-hatred, the more terrible because some part of him refused to accept it and made him feel guiltier. It was not a progression of words, but the instantaneous verdict of an emotion, a verdict that told him this then was his nature, this was his depravity, that the shameful desire he had never been able to conquer came to him in response to the only sight of beauty he had found, that it came with a violence he had not known to be possible, and that the only freedom now left to him was to hide it and to despise himself, but never to be rid of it so long as he and this woman were alive. He did not know how long he stood there, or what devastation that span of time left within him. All that he could preserve was the will to decide that she must never know it. He waited until she had descended to the ground, and the man with the notes had departed. Then he approached her and said coldly, "Miss Taggart, I am Henry Reardon." "Oh." It was just a small break. Then he heard the quietly natural, "How do you do, Mr. Reardon?" He knew, not admitting it to himself, that the break came from some faint equivalent of his own feeling. She was glad that a face she had liked belonged to a man she could admire. When he proceeded to speak to her about business, his manner was more harshly abrupt than it had ever been with any of his masculine customers. Now looking from the memory of the girl on the flat car to the gift certificate lying on the desk, he felt as if the two met in a single shock, fusing all the days and doubts he had lived between them. And by the glare of the explosion, in a moment's vision of a final sum, he saw the answer to all his questions. He thought, "Guilty. Guiltier than I had known, far guiltier than I'd thought that day. Guilty of the evil of damning as guilt that which was my best. I damned the fact that my mind and body were a unit, and that my body responded to the values of my mind. I damned the fact that joy is the core of existence, the motive power of every living being, that it is the need of one's body as it is the goal of one's spirit, that my body was not a weight of inanimate muscles, but an instrument able to give me an experience of superlative joy, to unite my flesh and my spirit. That capacity, which I damned as shameful, had left me indifferent to sluts, but gave me my one desire in answer to a woman's greatness. That desire, which I damned as obscene, did not come from the sight of her body, but from the knowledge that the lovely form I saw did express the spirit I was seeing. It was not her body that I wanted, but her person. It was not the girl in gray that I had to possess, but the woman who ran a railroad. But I damned